from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in his new book, Thank You for Being Late, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman examines the social and economic challenges posed by a world where everything is getting faster. He writes about workers' anxiety as machines perform increasingly sophisticated tasks and shares his prescription for more sustainable economic growth. We'll speak with the longtime foreign affairs columnist about the book and what a Trump administration might mean for the global economy. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. His newest book is titled Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Acceleration. And we welcome him back to the Forum program. Good to have you with us.
Michael, it's great to be back. I was trying to think how many times we've done this, but it's pretty much for all my books, so it's great to be here.
Well, we're all dancing partners, yes. And it's always a pleasure to have you. I want to talk about this book. It's sort of like the flat earth has gone to too much acceleration, but of this flat earth. But before we get into your book, I want to get into some things that are in the news.
Please.
And get your expertise on. You've written a lot about Donald Trump already, and you were opposed to his candidacy and had some, I thought, rather astute things to say about the whole campaign. But let's just talk about what's in the news now. I mean, the Taiwan deal brokered by Bob Dole. Whole question about lobbyists, the Boeing deal where a lot of people lose jobs as opposed to Carrier where they're supposed to gain jobs. I mean, it would seem like the conclusion one can come to in recent moves by this president-elect is can't tell what he's going to do next.
Yeah, you can't. And most of it, Michael, is for the wrong reasons. You know, a friend of mine observed that there's a fine line between an open mind and no mind. And you never know with Trump which side of that line he's on. What I find so disturbing about that Taiwan deal, now that we now know more about it, you know, his first reaction was to say, I just took the guy's call, you know, as if
the woman's call.
The woman's call. As if he was home and Melania shouted out to him, Donald, there's someone from Taiwan on the phone. Would you pick it up? You know, so it was so bogus. But then you find out. Something that to me is just really shameful that Bob Dole had been lobbying him for months at the pay of the Taiwanese government, $140,000, to try to shift him on Taiwan. And because he doesn't have deep knowledge of a lot of these issues to begin with.
Most of them. But he did inveigh against China during the campaign, a great deal, in fact.
But just the fact that you had all these barnacles around him. You know, what I really was struck by when he came to the New York Times and I was at that meeting is you sort of realize that, you know, the guy ran for president for the last 18 months. Nobody thought he was going to win. So the only people he attracted basically were goofballs and extremists, the Michael Flynns of the world, the Rudy Giuliani. And think about what it does to your brains. Whatever they were to begin with, then to be in a bubble with these people for 15 months. So he wins now suddenly, and the world opens up to him. Now you have other people trying to get in there, like Al Gore and whatnot, which I laud. But he's been surrounded by the good ship lollipop of goofballs, extremists, and conspiracy theorists. And there are people who want to take advantage of that. Guy doesn't know much. Let's push my Taiwan agenda. Guy doesn't know much about environment. Let's push big oil and coal because this is our last chance maybe to kill the renewable revolution. And I just think you just got to watch this guy and this moment like a hawk.
Well, since you mentioned coal and big oil and so forth, you got the trio of supernovas in your new book, Technology, the Market, and Climate Change, and you spent a good deal of time and attention to climate change. At first, he was talking about ripping up the Paris Agreement. You know, this is a myth that the Chinese propagated. It isn't even real. Now, again, there seems to be a kind of pivot. It's almost as if maybe the last person he talked to or he's come under a different influence.
Exactly. So the method to my madness, Michael, is that I opposed him as vigorously and viciously as I could for the last 15 months. I will probably be doing the same for the next 4 years. But in this plastic window on the issue that is, I think, most important because it's the most irreversible, who he appoints to these key climate positions and where he tilts the country on that. I am trying to encourage people to get in there and talk to him. Clearly, his daughter is pulling him in a certain way. There's a tug of war around him.
Plus, climate change comes up in these intelligence briefings.
Yeah. Oh, and you can bet when General Mattis gets in there, if you're CENTCOM commander, you know that the Syrian civil war was triggered in part by a four-year drought. So I want more people to get in there because if we can prevent him from making the worst appointments, if he can actually put scientists in there rather than some knucklehead coal industry-inspired climate denier, it's going to make a difference. And so that's been my focus since the election, really just that one issue. And I'll deal with the other stuff later. But right now, while he seems to be open or opening, I'm glad Al Gore was in there. And I'm trying to push the same ideas.
Of course, your book was written before the election. Are you still optimistic? Because the book really does kind of weigh in on optimism.
Yeah, well, you know, the reason for my optimism, Michael, I was thinking about it being here in San Francisco, is if you want to be an optimist about America, stand on your head. The country looks so much better from the bottom up than the top down. What I find all over the country are healthy communities where people are really getting together. There's still politics, but it's much more muted. And they're trying to solve these challenges of jobs and education and environment. They're doing it on the communal level. My hometown of Minneapolis and St. Louis Park are doing amazing innovation. But I find it all over the country. I find it here in San Francisco. And I think what's propelling the country is actually the health of a lot of our communities. We have others that are suffering. We heard from them in this election. But if you want to be an optimist, stand on your head.
Well, you did go home for this book, and you did, of course, you can't go home again. It's really true in terms of the changes, the generational changes that you really pinpoint in this book. Fact is, though, I mean, as you point out, the jobs went to microchips. They didn't necessarily go to Mexicans, and yet Trump has pretty much heralded this idea that we is it still a wall? Is it a fence now? I don't know. I'm having trouble keeping up. But the idea that those jobs have to be save for Americans and the carrier deal, it was really kind of a bogus deal. And the most part, it was, as Bernie Sanders pointed out here, he was on the program last week, paying through the nose and getting corporate benefits through the nose.
You know, Michael, it wasn't only a bogus deal in that, in effect, carrier was bribed to keep 800 to 1,000, I don't know the exact number of employees here.
Two figures have gone out, basically,
right,
the Trump figures.
Right, and theirs. But think about, Michael, what the signal that went out to 10,000 other CEOs. One signal was, I'm not building my next factory in America because I don't want to be bullied and strong-armed by this guy if I have to move it at some point. And the other, even more dangerous signal that went out is, somebody get me a robot. I'm going to automate. He can't bully me if I just shed jobs for automation and software. So it's going to have for a one-day sugar high for his followers, I think he sent a really dangerous message that will ultimately redound to the disfavor of workers.
We're talking to Tom Friedman. His new book is Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Acceleration. His other books include From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. How do you think the effect of this is going to be on the global economy? I mean, there are people who are certainly buttering up to Trump at the same time that they don't know how to read him. And in many instances, a lot of them are frankly afraid.
Yeah, I look, there is a argument that people are making. I'm not an expert on this, that, you know, we easily could get a real economic burst here if you get tax cuts, deregulation, and most importantly, a huge infrastructure spend.
Stocks are already up, except for Boeing, of course.
Right, exactly, today, yeah. But, you know, just as an aside, what's so scary about the Boeing thing, that whole interplay was started when the CEO of Boeing said, what are you doing with Taiwan? We do, I don't know, 25-30% of our business with China. Don't screw that up. And it seems that Trump retaliated by then going after their contract with Air Force One. This is crazy stuff. But anyways, we could get a economic boost, a short term, set up in many ways by Obama. You know, I mean, Obama's, look at the economy Obama got and the one he's handing off, so that could happen. If it happens, good. If it leads to more people getting hired, particularly blue collar workers, that's wonderful. But you want to make sure it's not just a short term sugar high and that that blows out the deficit and our kids pay the bill, 5-10 years down the road.
What do you think of Keith Ellison in charge, essentially, of the Democratic Party? I mean, he's being put forward. A lot of people are saying he's not the right pick. There's been a lot of criticism of this. The Democratic Party supposedly wants to win back working class people. Nancy Pelosi loses to Tim Ryan, who uses that whole argument. You've got to have young people. You've got to have people looking out for the working class. I mean, this is one of the great divisions now within that party.
Yeah, there's no question. So Keith is someone I know and like. He's actually the congressman from my little district in Minneapolis.
St. Louis.
St. Louis Park. Yeah, that I wrote about. Part of that's in his district, so I'm very fond of him.
Well, let me interrupt just for a second, because there's this old notion that the same people come from St. Louis Park. Tom Friedman, the Cohen brothers, and Al Franken. That's true, isn't
Norm Ornstein, Michael Sandel, Peggy Ornstein, Alan Weisman, who wrote someone like
I just mentioned the top of the
Oh, yeah, no. Dan Wilson, who wrote Someone Like You with Adele. We all came out of the same basic region at roughly the same time in the 60s and 70s.
But not you can't claim Dylan. He's hibbing, right?
Dylan was hibbing. He went to our summer camp, though, the Minneapolis Jewish summer camp, Herzl Camp, where Dylan went a few years before me.
Anyway, so we're back to the thread.
We call ourselves the Frozen Chosen.
That's Michael Chabon. No, it is. It's in the Yiddish.
Oh, is it really? Oh, interesting. I shouldn't bring these up with you.
We were talking about Boeing, and we're talking about just this whole picture.
So look, we could get a boost in the economy, I think it's one that Obama deserves enormous credit for laying the foundation for. Well, we're talking about the Democratic Party and Keith Ellison. So I think I really like Keith. I don't think it should be based on a personality. That is, because he's the only black Muslim in the Congress, the Democrats shouldn't nominate him right now. I think it's about what policies the Democratic Party is going to stand for. And I come from the Al Fromm wing, of Democrats, which is that I believe this party has to be for growing the pie, for being for entrepreneurship, and not just for redistribution. And so I think it's about what policies the party really stands for more than the guy. Keith's he's a really fine person.
There are supporters of Israel who are very concerned about his.
Yeah, what did he say? Well, you can imagine what I think, because what did he say? He said, our Middle East policy has been distorted by the focus around one country. I mean, the fact is, it's true. If that's the worst thing he said about Israel, he said many other things, made very clear he understands this is a special relationship. He happens to be very close and very supported by the St. Louis Park and Minneapolis Jewish community, because we actually know him best. So I have, he is a critical friend of Israel. And I think that's the right place for an American politician to be, frankly, because I think it's we do Israel no favors when we adopt the Israel right or wrong position. And so I'm not worried about that. But I don't even know who's running against him anymore, Michael, because now that Howard Dean has dropped out.
Right.
And so but I think it's much more about what policies the party adopts, what lessons it learns going forward. The Labour Party in England decided they lost because they weren't left enough. Well, now they are basically so far out in the wilderness, the British Labour Party is irrelevant. And I would not want that to happen to the Democratic Party.
Have you read Hillbilly Elegy?
I have. Just finished it.
Yeah. It's really a terrific book.
I think so.
We had the author on here. And the fact is, you've made the point that there's too much dismissiveness of Trump voters. These are people who have real concerns, real needs, and so forth. And the fact of the matter is the Democratic Party is going to have to work to get them back.
I consider myself a kindred spirit with J.D. Vance. The last column I wrote before the election was a letter to Trump voters. And I basically made the point that he is indecent. And I am opposing him because I think he's an indecent human being. But I don't think most of you are indecent. I think that you're caught up in a whirlwind of change, which I'm writing about in the book. And you need to understand he's not going to help you. His policies in the end will not help you.
So there will be disillusionment with Trump. That's inevitable.
I think it's inevitable if he continues down the path he's going to go down. But I go back to what we said at the beginning, Michael. This guy's capable of anything. He's capable of turning on a dime. And so I'm trying to actually use that to the advantage of Mother Nature and get him to rethink that. But he could go in any direction. He's a unguided missile in that sense.
Well, so I guess when you read your book is technology. I mean, there's a profound dislocation that you're writing about in this book, and it continues.
Yeah, well, the book is basically the book has really two themes. You know, one is that we are in the age of acceleration, and what's shaping the world in more ways, on more days, in more places is that we're in the middle of three giant accelerations at the same time with the three largest forces on the planet, which I call the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law. So Moore's Law, that the speed and power of microchips will double every 24 months. It's now up to about 30, but never mind. If you put it on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick, you know, that acceleration. The market for me is digital globalization. So not your grandfather's globalization, containers on ships, but everything that's now being digitized and globalized, Twitter, Facebook, PayPal. And Mother Nature is climate change, biodiversity loss, and population. If you put them all in a graph, they all look like hockey sticks. And I think the three are all intertwining now. More Moore's Law, more technology drives more globalization drives more climate and more solutions to climate. And they
it's all kind of synchronicity, really.
Exactly. And they are reshaping the world. The book is about how we then anchor ourselves in this world. In this age of acceleration, and learn to get the most out of these accelerations and cushion the worst. And the reason it's called Thank You for Being Late is that the book really celebrates, Michael, the importance of everything you can't download, the importance of all the things you have to upload the old-fashioned way, community, good teaching, good parenting, good spiritual leadership. Anchoring people in these kind of communities, I think, is going to be more important than ever.
Also celebrates the need to, as the old cliche would have, smell the flowers or just take kind of a ruminative relaxation from things. That's where you got the title from.
Yeah. I mean, the title comes from meeting people for breakfast in Washington, D.C. over the years. And every once in a while, someone would come 10, 15 minutes late and say, Tom, I'm really sorry. It's the weather, the traffic, the subway, the dog ate my homework. And one day, 3 years ago, I just spontaneously said to one of them, actually, Michael, thank you for being late. Because you were late, I've been eavesdropping on their conversation. Fascinating. I've been people watching the lobby. Fantastic. And most importantly, I just connected two ideas I've been struggling with for a month. So thank you for being late. And people started to get into it. They'd say, well, you're welcome. Because they understood I was giving them permission to pause. In fact, my favorite quote in the front of the book is from my friend Duff Seidman, who says, when you press the pause button on a computer, it stops. But when you press the pause button on a human being, it starts. It starts to reflect, reimagine, and rethink. And boy, don't we need to do a lot of that now in the age of acceleration.
We're talking to Tom Friedman, getting more retro in this age of acceleration.
I am.
Celebrating the community, celebrating basic elemental values, and also the need for quiet meditation and all of those kinds of things. You talk about the cloud a good deal in the book, and you say, is that an effect on human history that's comparable to fire and electricity?
Yeah, I think in time, the amplification that the cloud is doing in terms of, well, let me put it differently, the way I put it in the book, I think this cloud, in combination with the other set of technologies, is really changing four kinds of power. It's changing the power of one. Boy, what one person can do now is unlike anything we've seen before. We have a president-elect who can sit in his pajamas in his penthouse and communicate directly without any filter with now hundreds of millions of people.
Just 40 million on Twitter alone, I think.
But by the way, what's really interesting, I'm like, soak in the head of ISIS from Raqqa province. Mm-hmm. So the power of one is changing. The power of machines is changing. Machines now have all five senses. IBM Watson, I wrote about this 3 weeks ago, co-wrote a song with Alex the Kid that in 48 hours went to number 4 on iTunes. We're seeing a change in the power of ideas. Ideas now flow and change at a rate we've never seen before. 5 years ago, Barack Obama said marriage was between a man and a woman. Today, blessedly so, he says marriage is between any two people who love each other. And he followed Ireland in that position. So we see ideas now accelerating and how quickly they scale and change. And lastly, it's changed the power of many. We as a collective are now a force of and in nature, so much so that the new geophysical era is being named after us, the Anthropocene.
Well, you're also advocating here something that many people would rally and cheer to, the need for more moral innovation, as you call it, and a commitment to the common good. And these are basic, again, elemental values. But, you know, there's that darker side, excuse me, of all this technology, which you just mentioned, you know, the number of ISIS who are now connected, who can essentially appeal to future jihadists and people who are going to do us wrong, or do the West wrong, I should say. So the fact of the matter is, again, your optimism. And your optimism in terms of going back to elemental values when people are looking at their machines, maybe their whole neurology is changing, their neural pathways possibly and everything. Why the optimism?
So let's talk about that ethics question first and back into the optimism. So the ethics chapter, the first part of the book is about these accelerations. And the second part is how they're reshaping the workplace, politics, geopolitics, community, and ethics. So the ethics chapter is called Is God in Cyberspace? Comes from the best question I ever got on book tour. 20 years ago, I'm out selling Lexus in the Olive Tree, and a guy stands up in the audience one day and says, Mr. Friedman, I have a question. Is God in cyberspace? And I said, I have no idea. And I felt like an idiot. So I got home. I called my spiritual teacher. He's a rabbi. He lives in Amsterdam. Zvi Marx, a great Talmudist. And I said, Zvi, I got a question I've never had before. Is God in cyberspace? What should I have said? And he said, Tom, you know, in our faith tradition, we have two concepts of the Almighty. One is that he's almighty, the biblical concept. And the biblical concept is that he's almighty. He smites evil and rewards good. And if that's your view of God, he sure isn't in cyberspace, which is full of pornography, gambling, cheating, lying, prevarication, and now we know fake news. But at the same time, he said, we have a post-biblical view of God. And the post-biblical view of God is that God manifests himself by how we behave. So if we want God to be in cyberspace, we need to bring him there by how we behave there. So I put that in Lexus in the Olive Tree 20 years ago, paperback edition. I forgot about it. Well, in working on this book, I started telling that story again. And I said to myself one day, why are you telling that story again? And Michael, the reason is obvious, because everything's now moved to cyberspace. Now it's where we meet our spouse. It's where we meet our friends. It's where we do our business. It's where we do our learning. What does that mean? It means everything's moved to a realm where we're all connected, but no one's in charge. So therefore, what values prevail in cyberspace? And boy, we saw that in this election, fake news, hacking. What values prevail there? Is God in cyberspace or not is really going to matter.
Again, we're talking to Tom Friedman, his new book, Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. And there's a good deal of hope in this book about how adaptive we are to all of this. I mean, that comes through strong in most of your writing. But you also emphasize some things that a lot of people are pretty unenlightened about, like Hadoop and its role. Well, let's talk about that for a moment as we come up on the break.
Sure. Basically, my chapter on Moore's Law begins by asking the question, what the hell happened in 2007? And people say, 2007, that's such an innocuous year. Well, here's what I found in my research.
Look, it was the iPhone year, right?
Yeah, the iPhone came out in 2007. Hadoop, this incredibly important software that allowed for big data, happened in 2007. GitHub happened in 2007. The Kindle happened in 2007. Android happened in 2007. IBM Watson happened in 2007. Airbnb happened in 2007. The collapse in the price of sequencing a human genome happened in 2007. Solar energy, fracking, and Intel went off silicon in 2007. Turns out, Michael, 2007 may be one of the greatest technological points in history, and we completely missed it because of 2008.
And we're almost a decade away, literally. We're talking to Tom Friedman. We invite your calls. You can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us now. That number again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, Tom Friedman, 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times and author of a new book called Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist Guide to Thriving in the Age of Acceleration. His other books include From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. And we're talking, of course, about a number of issues, as is always the case when Tom Friedman is with us, but also talking about his book. And the book raises some really serious questions about the speed that we are moving to. Did you read Jim Glick's book when it came out? Way back when, New York Times writer?
I don't remember.
It was sort of before the 2007 and all this began, but we were on the cusp of it, and he was saying, it's too fast. Yeah. We just can't keep up with it.
And I have a chapter called Is It Just Too Damn Fast? You know.
Let me go to some comments here. Robert writes, for years, Tom Friedman has called for grand bargain-type budget deals, including cutting Social Security. Why won't he simply support raising the income cap for Social Security instead?
You know, for me, it's a question purely of sustainability. You know, when we have so many baby boomers about to retire now, It seems to me that we do have some obligation to our kids to make sure that Social Security is there for them. So I supported what President Obama proposed at the time, which is not cutting Social Security, but slowing down the rise by cutting the cost of living increment, the formula for that. That seemed to me to be a fair bargain and trade-off to ensure the sustainability of Social Security. And why should we risk that our kids not have it just so we can't change the cost of living rise? So that's really where I come from on that.
You're also in the book coming out again, Foursquare behind single payer. Is this really possible with this Republican Congress? Well, is it just a pipe dream at this point, as it has been for years?
I just start, Michael, from the position that if Sweden can do single payer, if Singapore can do single payer with better health outcomes, then how in the world can't we do single payer? You know,
the argument would be the counter argument: we're too big and we're too, uncontrollable in numbers.
But what I see now, I was reading before we went on the air the story of the Republicans. You know, we're going to take down Obamacare. First thing, we're going to take down Obamacare. You know, and some people say we have to have the solution up in 6 months, and other people, well, no, we need 3 years. It turns out that these things are really hard. If you want to cover all the major diseases and pre-existing conditions, then you have to have a big pool of healthy people who can basically pay for insurance. They don't need to cover the unhealthy people. To have that big pool, you need subsidies. Those are the hard and fast facts of it. And the idea that there was just this beautiful alternative to Obamacare that the stupid, you know, Democrats and Obama wouldn't proceed on, I think it's a fantasy, and I think we're going to watch the Republicans flail around on this. If they take down Obamacare without having a credible and better alternative for 22 million Americans, the world's going to come down on them, because a lot of their voters are going to lose their health care.
I'm going to go to our callers. Let me go first to a question, though, from Ben. With the creation of robots, it seems that the total amount of jobs worldwide will be shrinking. Shades of Jeremy Rifkin. Without mechanisms for redistribution of wealth, it seems that the working class has little chance. Has there been another time in history where these type of structural changes came on so many fronts?
I don't think so. So many fronts so fast, I can't think of it. But what I would say to Ben is that I think there's going to be a whole class of new jobs, Michael, around human-to-human interaction. Thanksgiving, a family friend was there and was talking to me about a new company called, I think it's called Paint It, where there's these bars now that host sessions for adults of paint by numbers. And so what is that about? Let me back up for a second. I have an interview in the book with our Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. He's an amazing guy. And we were talking about what's the most prevalent disease in America. Is it cancer, diabetes, heart disease? And our Surgeon General said, Tom, it's none of those. It's isolation. I said, wow. We live in the most connected age, and the Surgeon General is telling me that the truly biggest disease in the country is people feeling isolated. And I tell you that that fact, and I'm sure it is true, is already spawning so many new business opportunities and careers around forging community where people can feel connected, protected, and respected, and human-human to connections where people will not feel isolated. So who knew there was a company doing paint by numbers now? All right, and that company is going to make money for people, and there's going to be jobs, and they're going to need a massage at the end of the day. And, you know, if you try to predict what's going to come, you'll never do it. If horses could have voted, there never would have been cars. So, you know, that you got to stay open to these things and trust human ingenuity.
Well, you used an example, and I thought this was a fascinating example. Probably not enough time to get into the Surgeon General's report on addiction, which we spent an hour on, but since you mentioned the Surgeon General. But instead, I'm going to go to Niger with you because you talk about technology there, and, you know, climate change is happening. The population is increasing at the same time that crops are being wrecked and people aren't eating. The technology is trying to catch up with that at the same time. The population continues to explode.
Well, you know, the broad headline of that story, and it was a documentary I did for National Geographic on human migration migration from basically the Sahel region, the arid regions of West and Central Africa, to Europe. So we began in northern Senegal in these villages that have been completely depopulated of males from the ages of 18 basically to 65. They've all left because the land, because of climate change and incredible temperature rise there, the land can't support and the population can't support all these men. So then they connect up with WhatsApp, the globalization and the technology. There's now all these human trafficking networks there based on WhatsApp. And they flow through Niger, through Agadez, where the one of the UNESCO World Heritage Site, where the whole tourism industry has been flipped now into a human migration industry. And they try to come up through Libya into Europe. So what's the real headline there, Michael? It's that for Trump to think I can have an immigration policy without a climate policy is a complete fantasy. Most of the immigration swamp in Europe is not from the Arab world. It's basically three quarters from West and Central Africa. And Trump says, I'm going to build a wall. Can you build a wall bigger than the Mediterranean? I don't think so. And the Mediterranean can't hold these people back. So you have to have a completely synthetic understanding of the connection between climate, immigration, and work. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes in the book, another is from my friend Lynn Wells, who's teaches strategic studies. And Lynn says, you know, I don't think in the box, and I don't think out of the box. I think without a box. And I think that's very important because it is how I think. That I'm always arbitraging climate with technology, with finance, you know, with labor. Because if you don't see these things as a whole, you'll completely miss the picture. And one of the things I worry most about Trump is that he has no sense of the synthetic interaction between all these processes.
Many of us are worried also about the xenophobia and nationalism that's crept into this whole alt-right movement and what influence it may have. Steve Bannon, you know, looked upon as a Darth Vader type, yeah, or a Cheney type figure and so forth. I mean, and this stuff is spreading globally. I mean, it's the internet.
We're seeing it in Europe and it spreads globally. And, you know, the internet, people have to remember, it's an open sewer of untreated, unfiltered information. And if we aren't educating our young people, our citizens, to have
we got to drain the swamp?
No, but we have to, people have to have the filter. To know how to read, to know fact from fiction. But they also have to have the moral, you know, grounding as well. Think about this. Mike Flynn, who's going to be our next national security advisor, and Mike Flynn Jr.
Was just fired,
thank God. But his father, you know, was doing the same thing, basically. They propagated a lie that a pizza parlor on Wisconsin Avenue near my home in Minneapolis, where I actually eat, in the back room, Hillary Clinton and her supporters are running a pedophile ring. It is the most vile, disgusting thing. And to think we have people near the centers of power who actually would do that kind of thing is terrifying.
We'll bring in our callers. And by the way, you can join us with Tom Friedman at 866-733-6786 or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. Here's Philip. Philip, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So Joseph Stiglitz is an American Nobel Prize winner. He was chief economist of the World Bank, and he wrote an article that in Vanity Fair that talked about the Great Depression and said the reason for the Great Depression was because of the advent of electricity and gasoline, and that displaced all of these rural workers, and that nothing that the New Deal did really did it. It was the relocation because of World War II. And then he goes forward to today where we have the internet and computing and soon to be self-driving cars. And, you know, we did have the Great Recession. And, you know, it appears that the conditions may be ripe, actually, for a second Great Depression. And you seem to be an optimist. How do you reconcile those?
First of all, Philip, I have to take my hat off to you. I didn't know anybody else in the world read that article or remembered that article. But that was an incredibly smart article. And I've talked to Joe about it and asked him why he, you know, just did it in Vanity Fair and didn't do really a book about it or a much longer treatise. I think it is fascinating that this idea that the Great Recession, the Great Depression and the Great Recession were both triggered by incredible leaps in technology that were faster than people could absorb and led to the crushing of a certain sector of the economy that pulled down, you know, banks and whatnot. Look, why am I an optimist? let me start by saying that my friend Amory Lovins, the physicist, is a real teacher of mine. When people ask him, is he an optimist or a pessimist, he always says, I'm neither, because they're just two forms of fatalism. Everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be awful. Amory says, I believe in applied hope. And that really is, A, what I believe in. But
is he still up in Colorado?
He's at Rocky Mountain Institute still. But to Phillips, it's a very important question. We did come out of the Great Depression. We needed at that point a huge government intervention. I don't oppose that right now. But I think as I was saying to Michael, that I think human creativity and innovation is far greater than people realize, and that trying to save every coal job or every blue-collar job and ignoring the massive innovation I've seen at the community level. I was just at an event where someone described their job as tagging sharks for Twitter. Well, who the hell knew there was a job tagging sharks for Twitter? You'll never know. You'll never see these jobs coming. But if you keep the economy open and flexible, I think they will come. The fact is, we do have 4.6% unemployment today. I realize there are a lot of people who are taking themselves out of the workforce. But the fact is, jobs we are on an upslope. So I think you have to basically have some confidence in human imagination and creativity to find new ways to create employment. And I think many of them are not going to be about, again, what my friend Dov Seidman calls hands. They're not going to be about heads. They're going to be about connecting hearts. It's going to be about human-to-human opportunities. And I think we're just at the beginning of that.
You talk, and let me thank the caller. I want to go to more of your calls in just a moment. But you talk about the world wasn't exactly an oyster in our era, but we could go out there and get different kinds of jobs. And now you talk about your daughters, I'm thinking about my daughters, there's limitation, there's a ceiling there in terms, they're entirely different kind of jobs. It's a different world. In fact, I think I've got a caller on this point. Arif, you're on. Morning.
Okay. Thank you so very much for taking my call. I had actually two questions. My first question is that somewhere Mr. Friedman mentioned that the apparently has said that think like an immigrant who came to United States and they didn't have anything, for example, and started from the beginning and seized any kind of opportunity and so on. But now my question is, Mr. Friedman, what would you like to say to immigrant kids who are living in the United States, apparently came to the United States recently? For example, myself, I came to the United States from Afghanistan and I have three kids. And they were asking a lot of questions about America, about American culture, society, about their future. What would you say to them and how they would think to be a better Americans in the future and be helpful and work with other communities and be adaptable? What would you say to them?
All right, let me stick with the question that you've raised here, Arif. Go ahead.
Well, it's a very good question, Arif. You know that I'm incredibly sort of pro-immigration. I've always said, we do have to control our border. A country has to control its border. So I'm for a very high wall with a very big gate. Okay, so I want there to be large controlled immigration, both of the energetic low-skilled and the high IQ risk-takers that really have made our economy. I can understand right now that there are immigrants who are deeply unsettled. I gave a talk last month. I was in central Iowa, and there was a college professor drove me to and from my hotel to the event. And along the way, she mentioned her husband's from Pakistan and that and he's terrified right now. And that's just a terrible thing as far as I'm concerned, because when Trump sends those signals, not only does it make the immigrants who are already here, frightened and unnerved for no reason, but the most important signal is stay away. Stay away. Well, if we were to miss another generation of both the low-skilled energetic and the high IQ risk-takers who do start the Googles and the Amazons, Jeff Bezos' family's from Cuba, what will it be to our economy? I mean, our economy is so unique in the world because we've been over 250 years more open to the energetic and the high IQ risk takers. And if we close that off, we'll just revert to the global mean. We'll just become like any other country.
Again, our guest is Tom Friedman, and I'm going to bring as many of you on here as I can. Let me go to Menlo Park next. Wynn, you're on.
Thanks. With the split in Congress among the Republican Party during the election and so many people not supporting Trump, and with McConnell and Ryan now having a majority in the Republican Party in Congress, what do you think is going to happen, and who's going to drive the bus?
Again, a very good question, and I have to say, obviously, I don't know. But you know, if you just pick up the paper today, you'll see some very interesting splits that you know are going to emerge in that party. First of all, you have the whole free market wing of the party saying, Trump, what are you doing telling a business how many employees it has should have and where they should be put? So that really flies right in the face of the free market wing of the party. And then you have on the healthcare issue, people saying the Freedom Caucus, you know, we got to get rid of Obamacare right now because our base wants it. And you have others saying, well, what is your plan? So I think we're just at the beginning of some really interesting fissures within the Republican Party. How deep it'll go, I don't know. I wouldn't predict. But, you know.
Excuse me, not only what is your plan, but also things that people want to retain, particularly in districts which have been
absolutely
heavily Republican, but nevertheless are affected if this is going to be taken away.
You know, Michael, Donald Trump, the most reckless thing we did in electing Donald Trump is not just overlooking the character issues. We know, I'm just speaking of the country as a whole and the Electoral College. It's we elected a man who had no second graph. He had a one graph election, make America great again. But there was no second paragraph.
Drain the swamp.
Yeah. I mean, again, I repeat, no second paragraph. So what he's just now winging it here, making it up as he goes along. And I think as he lands now in different issues, healthcare or the workplace, you're going to see some real cracks within the Republican Party. It's fun to watch the Wall Street Journal editorial page wrestling with him because you know, they were for all these things, get rid of Obamacare, you know, but Trump's not a particularly free trader. So I think we're just at the beginning here.
Let me take some more of our calls and we'll go to another listener in Berkeley. David? That's you. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Yeah, I just have a comment on it. Seems like after the Great Depression, there was a period where economic adulthood became delayed and high school became a, sort of a normal part of our preparation for the world. And I wonder if we're not entering a similar period now where we need more education to compete as labor is less valuable. And it seems to me that the Affordable Care Act is actually the first official foray into that, with the provision that adult children maintain their parents' health care. I wonder if you have a comment on that.
A really good point, and I deal with this in the book because I actually put my own – I actually create what I call Mother Nature's political party. You have to read the book to understand why it's Mother Nature's political party. But I actually create a platform, what if Mother Nature were running in this election? And to just your point, the point I make is I think the new social contract in America is that you can be a lifelong employee wherever you're working, but only if you're a lifelong learner. And if that is the case, and that is the days when you could get a four-year degree and then dine out on that for 30 years, those are over. But if we're asking every American to be a lifelong learner, then there are two new elements that have to come into that social contract. One, I think every employer, and there are many starting to do this, do have to provide the learning opportunities and resources for workers to do that. They have to maybe do it on their own time, but they have to have the resources and the opportunities. And at the same time, I argue in the book that all post-secondary education should be tax deductible. We cannot tell people you have to be a lifelong learner, but you basically have to spend half your career paying off the debts for your lifelong learning. And I also argue in the book that if I could wave a magic wand, every BA in America would be limited to 3 years. I went to graduate school at Oxford. They have a 3-year BA. Israel is a technion. Their universities are just 3 years. I can't understand why we can't educate people in 3 years and give every American a 25% cut in education costs right off the top.
Let me thank the caller and go to a question from a listener named Craig. He tweets, Trump got a standing ovation at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee this year. I'm wondering what Mr. Friedman makes of that.
Not a lot. It's easy to get a standing ovation at AIPAC if you say, I'm never going to challenge the Israeli government.
Or if you say something about the Iran agreement.
Right, and you trash the Iran agreement. Meanwhile, what's the facts? Israel does not want the Iran agreement trashed, because if it were trashed, Israel would have to immediately produce a military alternative, or at least a military deterrent that it doesn't want to do right now. And I really fear for Israel. I've told my Israeli friends that you have never been more home alone. That is, you're not abandoned, but it's worse. You've never been in a position where you can actually choose whatever future you want. You know what? If Israel decides tomorrow to annex the West Bank, I'm not sure the Trump administration or the Congress would actually do anything. And if Israel decides tomorrow to give back the West Bank, I don't think they would do anything. But Israel is on its own now. And what I fear is, you know, Bibi Netanyahu, I've always argued, Michael, is a guy who's always dog paddling in the Rubicon. He never crosses it. He just gets to the middle and dog paddles. And so as a result, Israeli policy just keeps drifting. When a country's politics drifts, what happens is the most dynamic element within that society wins. And right now, the most dynamic element within Israeli society is the settler movement. And willy-nilly, they are taking Israel into a one-state solution. So the Trump presidency, in many ways, could be the midwife of a one-state Israel, and woe be unto Israel and the Jewish people if that happens.
Question from Enrique. Would Hillary be president of the United States if she was a member of the NRA and backed gun rights?
It's a legitimate question. I don't know. Hard to know. I'm glad she didn't. So, 'cause I think there are principles you have to stand for. I do think the hacking of Russia has not got by Russia of this election has not gotten nearly the attention it deserves. Our election was hacked by a foreign government in cooperation with WikiLeaks. And we just said, whatever, you know, that was really important. I mean, besides the Comey stuff. Now, you can say, well, it never should have been this close. I think the worst thing Hillary did do was say half of Trump's supporters are deplorable. Never touch people's dignity like that. And then she said, well, I just meant half and you're not in. Hey, am I in the right half, the wrong half? Am I a deplorable, half a deplorable? It was a really stupid thing to say. And I think it sent that it touched people's dignity. And when you play with that, you're really playing with fire.
Again, we're talking to Tom Friedman, his new book, Thank You for Being Late. And another caller will go to you next. Judith, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Thomas, Judith Paul is here. We spent time at the Aspen Institute. My comment is that trade protectionism also contributed greatly to the world depression as countries like the United States put up the Smoot-Hawley tariff, started protecting their own markets. All other countries, because trade is a global phenomenon, started protecting their country. So when everybody turned to protect their perceived private interest, the public interest went down the drain. So that's the danger to me of Trump saying he's going to erect 35% tariffs. Trade flows just can't switch that fast. So Mexico will be hurt. China will be hurt.
I think it's a very good point, and I couldn't agree more. You know, I was always of the view that the American auto industry was protected to death by the Michigan congressional delegation. When you get a law passed that you can't even study improved mileage standards, when you protect them from all foreign competition, they get the signals late, but they eventually get the signal, and it almost destroyed them. And so I'm for three radical initiatives. I'm actually for radical openness on trade. I'm for radical safety nets. I think we need to really strengthen our safety nets and trampolines. And I'm for radical education. That is, I think we need to be doing everything to enable every American to be a lifelong learner. I think those three things totally go together. Be open to the world. You'll get the signals first. You'll be always more adaptable, and you'll attract more of the high IQ risk takers who start companies and the energetic people who can drive them. But be radically working to improve the educational opportunity for every American and make sure we have the safety nets in place, because this age of accelerations will be just too damn fast for some people.
If we're talking about Trump in some predictable way, you were talking about hacking, for example, and WikiLeaks in Russia, seems to be tilting more toward Russia. I mean, at least that's the assumption of many. In fact, many think he kind of sees himself more like being like Putin than Mussolini, though he makes those gestures and faces more like Mussolini. Hmm. What I'm thinking about here is the fact that, as I said earlier, during the campaign, he inveighed against China and excoriated China to almost ridiculous degrees. And now, with Taiwan, there's real tension there, I think. He's even condemned China in the South China Sea and so forth. He's come out with all these statements. TPP is going to go by the wayside. I mean, this is a big global shift. I mean, if you think about it in those terms, is it not? More toward Russia, more away from China, and even contentious. And we owe China so much money. Trump owes China so much money.
$1.1 trillion, and God knows how much he owes. You know, Michael, I in the middle of writing this book, I broke my shoulder. And I learned something when you break your shoulder. It's connected to everything. Well, I had no idea it was connected to how much to my breast muscles, my fingers, my lower back, my middle back. And what worries me about this moment generally now is people are playing with big systems that are connected to all kinds of things you have no idea. When you play with the China-Taiwan-U.S. security relationship, when you play with the EU, when you play with NATO, you better know what you're doing because you start pulling out threads and then things just completely unravel. These institutions are all imperfect. They are made by human beings. But they kept the world tilted towards security, stability, and prosperity for a long time by the great statesmen and women who built them post-World War II. And what worries me today is people are just playing lightly with big systems.
Now you're worried, but you're still optimistic.
You know, it's how I'm built. If you grew up where I did in Minnesota at the time I did, you have to be an optimist.
Yeah, a lot of nostalgia for that Minnesota comes through in this book. It was actually pleasant and delightful in many ways to read. It reminded me a lot of my own background, of course. Thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you.
Always a treat, Michael. Thank you.
Thomas L. Friedman, 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with The New York Times. His new book is Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Acceleration. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can, by the way, continue this discussion online simply by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. I remind you that an hour is repeated in the evening, and you can also hear us on Sirius during this hour. Many Sirius listeners with us this hour. Thank you for being with us, all of you, Sirius, radio, internet, however you're listening to Forum. And I also want to remind you who is behind the scenes here in the Forum program. We've got a great team, and you should know these names. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer today is Katie McMurrin, and Danny Bringer, of course. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, and we're going to talk to the housing czar in the next hour. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.